So this is number 20, and we're going to 20 to 30 to 40 to 40 to 40. Just to keep you going. Ready? In its recent decision on admissibility, the ECHR revisited this topic and applied these same tests. The following matters emerged from this decision. Little 1. The proper function of the European Supervisory Court on the second main issue is to decide whether the derogation was a genuine response to an emergency situation and whether the absence of judicial control of extended detention was justified. Little 2. In making this assessment, the supervising court should have regard to the authority's margin of appreciation and the nature of the safeguards which existed to prevent abuse. Little 3. Nothing had happened in the 9 years since two other people were detained, such as to lead the court to contravene the authority's assessment of the situation in Northern Ireland. Little 4. As to the measures the authorities took in the present case, it was not the role of the supervising court to substitute its view as to what measures were most appropriate or expedient at the relevant time in dealing with an emergency situation for that of the government, which had direct responsibility for establishing the balance between the taking of effective measures to combat terrorism on the one hand and respecting individual rights on the other. As between the national authorities and the Strasbourg court, therefore, it is for the national authorities to decide the answer to the first two main issues I have identified above, and for the Strasbourg court to be willing to afford them a wide margin of appreciation, bearing in mind their direct responsibility for the safety of their state when it assesses whether their answers were correct in law, or whether it should controvert them or substitute its own view. In all the cases concerned with Northern Ireland prior to October 2000, however, there was no mechanism for judicial supervision of the relevant decisions of the government or the legislature of this country at national level. A number of recent decisions of the courts, however, have pegged out the course a national court should adopt, particularly in a matter affecting national security. They are now well known. It is convenient only to set out certain principles which I derive from Lord Hoffman's speech. 1. When there is an appeal to SIAC, it is the Home Secretary, not the SIAC, who is the principal decision maker. 2. It must be remembered that the Home Secretary has the advantage of a wide range of advice from people with day-to-day involvement in security matters, which SIAC cannot match. 3. Because what is at issue is an evaluation of risk, an appellate body traditionally allows a considerable margin to the original decision maker. It should not ordinarily interfere with a case in which the Home Secretary's view is one which could reasonably be entertained. 4. Even though a very different approach may be needed when determining whether an appellant's ECHR Article 3 rights are likely to be infringed, this deferential approach is certainly required in relation to the question whether a deportation is in the interest of national security. 5. Although SIAC has the express power to reverse the exercise of a discretion, they should exercise restraint by reason of common sense, recognition of the nature of the issue and of the difference in the decision-making processes and responsibilities of the Home Secretary and SAIC. 6. The events of 11th September are a reminder that in matters of national security, the cost of failure can be high. Decisions by ministers on such questions with serious potential rights for the community, therefore, require a legitimacy which can be conferred only by entrusting them to persons responsible to the community through the democratic process. Any judicial assessment of the quality of the Home Secretary's decision-making process in the present case is inevitably made more complicated by the fact that he told a parliamentary committee in October 2001 that there was no immediate intelligence pointing to a specific threat to this country. There is, however, as I understand it, no direct challenge to his good faith. It appears to me that the answer to the conundrum posed by the language he used must be found in identifying the proper meaning of the word imminent, as it appears in the French text of ECHR Article 15. This is a necessary part of the process in determining what the expression public emergency threatening the life of the nation really means. SIAC considered this issue in paragraph 24 of their determination. They made the following points. 1. It is not the imminence of a threat which is required, but the actuality or imminence of an emergency. This distinction is by no means an unreal one. 2. The measures which involve the need to derogate are required to try to prevent the outrages, which would have been a disastrous effect if they had occurred. It would be absurd to require the authorities to wait until they were aware of an imminent attack before taking the necessary steps to avoid such an attack. 3. What is required is a real risk that an attack will take place unless the necessary measures are taken to prevent it. 4. An emergency can exist and can certainly be imminent if there is an intention and capacity to carry out serious terrorist violence, even if nothing has yet been done. and even if plans have not reached the stage when an attack is actually about to happen. I have not found this issue of interpretation an easy one. The importance of ECHR attaches to personal liberty and the rule of law is underlined by the fact that it requires an actual or imminent emergency of the type described in Article 15 before a contracting state may lawfully derogate from the protections afforded by Article 5.1. While considering the issues in this anxious case, I have constantly reminded myself of the powerful dissenting opinion of Mr. Justice Jackson, with whom Mr. Justice Frankfurter joined in the United States case of 1953. I quote just two passages. Fortunately, it is still startling in this country to find a person held indefinitely in executive custody without accusation of crime or judicial trial. Executive imprisonment has been considered oppressive and lawless since John at Runnymede pledged that no free man should be imprisoned, dispossessed, outlawed or exiled save by the judgment of his peers or by the law of the land.